And second, I believe that we must make agreements with other countries and pass laws, if we have to, which will prevent the extinction of a business or its substantial impairment of a of an industry by a sudden incursion of imports. We have had some cases in which imports increased by 150 or 200% within one trading year, which can put anybody out of business before they can adjust. And that is a proper case for voluntary agreements like the textile agreement. And I believe we need one to keep us from being inundated in the automobile field, to give our people an opportunity to make the new, small, compact, gas-efficient car.
Senator, your opponent in the Republican primary has made age the paramount issue. Do you feel that his commercials have been unfair?
In politics, as in love, I suppose you could say that nothing is fair or unfair. They have sought to denigrate me in a way which I've never encountered in 24 years of running for the Senate, or before even in running for the House. And I don't think that it certainly is not high-level politics. And it's also destructive, but I'll deal with it. And I believe the voter is very well able to deal with it. And many voters have told me that they consider these tactics highly counterproductive.
Senator, reverting to your campaign once again, last week your opponent leveled charges that you refused to debate him. Any comment on that at all?
Well, we have three debates scheduled for the end of this week. I think that's hardly refusing. And I want to tell you something. Considering what the way he's carried on about me with phony pictures and whatnot, if I did refuse, I'd be eminently justified. But I respect the people.
Senator, do you feel comfortable? You're the only Republican speaker here. The whole day is going to be probably an attack on Ronald Reagan. It started early this morning. Mr. Moynihan is no doubt doing that, and Governor Kerry will do it too. Is it comfortable to be the Republican in this situation, and what brought you here?
I have been in this situation many times in a long career, and I'm completely comfortable and relaxed. And I think it's a good thing that the Republicans are not shut out. I don't think that we want that kind of a wall between the parties in this, what is a centrist political society. And I believe that I have had a big part in keeping that from happening. So long as I'm around, it's pretty hard for the most ardent partisan to give up on Republicans, which is a good thing.
Senator, I'd like to go back to the trade pact. You mentioned one on autos. Could you be a little more specific there? I know this is an area labor is very interested in. They'd to have a lot more restrictions on imports.
Right. Well, I go back to the voluntary agreements on textiles, which worked very well, and which I think need to be followed in matters of this character, where a sudden inundation of imports threatens the existence of a whole industry, which is what we're facing. And I believe the proper way to handle it at that point is by voluntary agreement.
Not by legislation, quotas.
It's never been necessary to do that, because every nation knows that we have the residual power. So no nation, and certainly not Japan, is going to make us do that. And if it's very clear to them that this matter has got to be dealt with, it will be dealt with. And we've had that experience. You know, there was a lot of foot dragging in the textile agreement, which was a very tough one. It was finally made and is held together.
In autos, how would you do it? You go to Japan and you say you can only import so many?
I'm sure we're in Japan now saying, and that's what we're saying, that we simply cannot allow this market to be inundated. And I'm sure it'll work.
Senator, excuse me if you've answered this question before, but when Ms. Meyerson was campaigning the Cascos last week, she said that if she were your opponent, she would to pick an issue to differentiate the two of you would be one of emphasis, and that she would be much more concerned with national policies. And she said you have been too concerned with foreign policies in your years in the Senate.
Well, I think that's not true, because all Ms. Myerson apparently may have is her reading of the newspapers. And naturally, these great world issues get a lot more publicity than the bread and butter dams and bridges and grants and housing, and immigration work, and so on. My office is considered one of the best on Capitol Hill because it's delivered to cities and villages and towns and counties in these ways. In the campaign, I'm making that very, very clear, and I think showing a very satisfactory record on that subject.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you all very much.
And the other members of the council, all of you are presidents of trade unions in the state of New York. I am very honored and pleased to be your guest at the annual convention. As you consider matters of great importance to our country and to the members of the Federation. I know at least as well as any senator that the history of progressive social legislation that we have compiled over the past several decades would be meager indeed were it not for the far-sighted and forceful role of the trade union movement in the work of the federal government. Before I share with you some of my thoughts in what is a perilous time at home and abroad for the people of the United States, let me join with you first in paying my personal tribute in the presence of organized labor of my state to two illustrious sons of the American labor movement, President George Meany and President Paul Hall. I, with you and millions of working men and women, was saddened by their passing, and grateful for their lives. George Meany, whom I knew very well personally for so many years, was the towering figure of American labor in modern times. And he'll continue to inspire the United States labor movement for decades to come. He understood, and understood very well, the inseparability of democracy and the free trade union movement. I'm deeply gratified to have been associated with him in so much landmark social, economic, and labor legislation, which had the fundamental purpose of bringing dignity and security to working men and women and of improving the lot of the poor among our peoples. And Paul Hall, whom I knew for many years, in a very difficult field, was a real hero of American labor. A few outside the trade union movement know how tough is the seafarer's life and the seafarer's work. And Paul led those men with indefatigable strength and with unbelievable patriotism. And so, perhaps the best tribute that I can pay to these two great leaders is to say that I have spent probably the greater part of my political life fighting for many of the same goals that this Federation stands for and for which they led. Through the years, we have shared many victories, you and I, but we have also shared some disappointments and defeats. I have served in the United States Senate for 24 years, longer than any other New Yorker in the history of this state. And I have been accorded just about every honor that any American could ask for. Now, my walls are covered with plaques and diplomas. There's one that doesn't hang on my wall, though. That's the most precious treasure of all to me. And that is the confidence and trust of the people of this state. And especially the confidence and trust of its millions of workers. People ask me, what's the secret of my political life? My answer is, there's no secret to it at all. It comes simply from my own human experience and from what I would call a passion for fair play and decency in our society and in our government. As a child on the Lower East Side of New York, I saw what happens when workers are denied their dignity and decent wages and working conditions and their right to organize in order to attain them. I didn't just read about it in the newspapers. Those of you who are interested in history may be interested in reading my remarks on the occasion of the consideration of the Taft-Hartley Act in the 40s when I served in the House of Representatives. I told them how all our boarders were all passionate trade union advocates would come in night after night, bloody and battered, or absent because they'd been sent to jail, all because they had the temerity to try to equalize their bargaining power with management by joining a union or causing one to be organized. And so when President Truman vetoed Taft-Hartley in the 40s, I voted in the House of Representatives, one of the very few, to sustain his veto, because I thought it was an attempt to stop the growth of the labor movement in its tracks, long before workers had acquired true equality of opportunity at the bargaining table. And perhaps it is symptomatic of my career that within the last year, I've served the same function in the Labor Reform Act, which also was directed toward the same end. You and I know that without a system of free collective bargaining, a strong independent trade union movement, freedom becomes impossible. As you and I know, in many ways, and after all these years, much in our basic law still denies workers equality with management and the opportunity to organize trade unions. That's why I fought with all my energy for this labor reform bill to which I've just referred. Interestingly enough, we fell just one vote short of breaking the filibuster against the bill in the Senate. One lonely vote. We couldn't get 60, we could only get 59. It shows you how things hang by a hair, because it is my judgment that one of the major economic problems bedeviling this country was because of that Labor Reform Act and its failure, a certain erosion of confidence between management and labor on the issue of whether or not labor should have equal rights. That's what it came down to, equal rights. Equal rights to address those who were to be organized, equal rights to persuade them. No more, no less, just equal. I was dedicated to that proposition. And I told management exactly that, that that was my purpose, and that I was perfectly ready to join in any amendment to the Labor Reform Act. And I might tell you, so was Tom Donahue, who ran this whole operation for the AFL-CIO. Anything that was reasonably requested in order to make it just even, that's all we asked. But instead, an enormous enterprise of small business was organized to come down to Washington passionate about defeating this act. And 95% of all those small businessmen were not affected. Were not affected at all by the Labor Reform Act. Didn't reach them. The reason was that they were asked to identify with American business. And they were persuaded that their rights and their interests were tied up with what the general business community on a level far above theirs, desire. Now, one could say very easily that this was their failure, But I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it was also our failure, because the small businessmen and their economic interests are much more identifiable with the economic interests of working people than they are with the economic interests of what's called big business. And so there is an enormous area in which we need great effort on the part of the Federation, so that we have a much better meeting of the minds and cause our failure in respect of the Labor Reform Act, which, as I've just said, and I've repeated with deep conviction, has been very harmful to our country, because it accentuated the divisiveness, the gulf, between trade union labor and management. And at this very moment, when we face so many perils, it is very essential that that be repaired. And perhaps it cannot be repaired without some new effort to deal with a labor reform bill which will give this equality to which I refer, between working people and people who have businesses. Very serious, my friends, I want to tell you that. Mistake it not. And then there's the 14D, which continues on the books of the United States. What a grotesque perversion of the English language, that phrase, right to work. The only right Section 14D gives anyone is to be a free rider and to reap all your hard-won gains at the bargaining table without sharing the burdens and responsibilities that led to those gains. And let us remember that though there's no such right to work law, quote unquote, in the state of New York, the fact is, and that's a great blessing for our state, the fact is that its presence in so many other states materially impairs the opportunity for decent labor legislation, and materially impairs the ability to organize, and materially impairs the opportunity of the 85 to 90 million Americans who work for a living. And the time is coming, and I'll deal with that in a few minutes, when that right and that opportunity is going to be super important. So we were right on 14D, we were right on labor reform, but we lost. And we lost because we're going through troubled times. And many Americans are dissatisfied and are looking for retrenchment rather than progress on labor issues and on social issues. I don't have to tell you the serious problems we face. You and your family members know every time you pull into a gas station and pay the tab, every time you get to the checkout counter at the supermarket, every time an aging obsolescent plant closes in your town and city, and thousands of workers become statistics on the unemployment rolls. Just think of it. You know how demoralizing it is for any one of you to be unemployed. Well, multiply that by 8 million. That's USA. End of August 1980. And every time you pay your income tax and realize that despite paying more and more, you're getting in a standard of living less and less, you realize the peril we're in. And if that wasn't enough, our country is in grave peril abroad. It is no secret to you that it's the alliances of the United States which make the United States defense what it should be. And when those alliances are in disarray, as they are today, when practically every one of them has a different variety of trouble, whether it's NATO in Europe, or the Rio Pact in South America, or Central America, efforts which are so disorganized, as we see by the troubles in Nicaragua and in other places in Central America. When you find grave concerns about our mutual security agreements with the Japanese, with Australia, New Zealand, with the Philippines, and with other nations, you realize how tumultuous is this period. when you realize, too, that we have pending in Washington an agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union seeking to limit nuclear armament, and that's completely stymied and stalled. And instead of that, we're talking about an arms race, both the Russians and ourselves. An arms race. And an arms race in what? Nuclear arms. I don't believe any of you, with the wildest imagination that you have, can begin to conceive of the destructive power to human beings and the property of a nuclear weapon. You just can't. Just bear in mind that Hiroshima, which resulted in 160,000 casualties, was a fraction of what there is in just one nuclear weapon of an intercontinental variety today. Now, there are some who would use these grave problems to turn back the clock on much of the social and economic progress which we have made over the years. They would mindlessly feel that the child of a working woman should not have the daycare that that child's entitled to through the intercession of government as an aid in the absence of private business doing it, which it should do. They would feel that the way to fight inflation is to make it more possible rather than less possible for the poor to be hungry, for people to be jobless, for the ignorant to go uneducated, and for the unemployed worker to stand in greater jeopardy. I have fought this kind of thinking all my political life, and with your help, we have prevented much of it from intruding upon our progress. But we're in the gravest danger again today that those forces may be successful, and they need to be rolled back. Now, I'm not given to forensic speeches which do not instruct us as to what we ought to do about these things. First, we must emphasize their seriousness and their danger. And second, we must realize, because I do, that if returned to the Senate of the United States, I am one senator among 100. And therefore, what counts in that return are three things. One, experience. We learn a lot from that, as you all know. Second, seniority. That still counts in terms of all the credit cards you pile up and all the relationships which you cement by reciprocal assistance one to the other and in the hierarchy of the Senate and committees, etc. Now that I require. And so when it came to judging whether this was the time to quit, which I had every right to do, based on the record of 32 years of public elective office, all of it apparently to the great satisfaction of yourselves and all of my constituents. I had to think very seriously about whether I could utter the words of retirement, whether I could at this stage of my life turn my back on the unbelievable problems which face our people and on the tipping points between peace and war, between prosperity and depression, and between justice and injustice. And I found that I just couldn't utter the words. And so I didn't turn my back, but have offered myself to the people of our state again and to you, if you want me, to go back to the Senate and continue. I generally have told it to you as it is, not the way I wish it could be or you wish it could be. And we are in a moment of thoughtfulness here in a great convention like this one, on the threshold of great electoral decisions. I believe we must recognize that our American industrial plant is deteriorating and is growing obsolescent, and that we are not keeping up with the competition, which is very real and severe, especially in Germany and in Japan, but by no means in those countries alone. And so, it is essential that we structure our fiscal and tax policies to encourage investment in new and modernized plants and facilities. The Senate Finance Committee, only last week, took the first step towards shaping a tax cut bill to help us achieve that objective. You should know that since 1977, I have been the chairman of the task force designated by all the senators on the Republican side for the purpose of drafting an economic program. And at the central point of my economic program has been this particular incentive tax cut. So that I'm deeply gratified, and while I favor the general approach which is embodied in the bill, I'm concerned that simply cutting taxes to enable new structures, new machinery, new equipment to be acquired could encourage the indiscriminate closing of plants and the loss of jobs in our inner cities, particularly in the Northeast. That would be tragic and unnecessary as well. We have millions of highly skilled workers in these established industrial areas. Workers who are willing and anxious to use their skills in productive work. And our reindustrialization effort must take these men and women into account. And that is why I will offer, when the measure comes before us, a proposal for targeting these tax cuts with a priority which will encourage businesses to invest in these areas of high unemployment for purposes of reindustrialization. Now, one other thing which is terribly important to you, and please hear me carefully. There's got to be a big question in this reindustrialization, which could change the face of America. And indeed, our industrial performance requires that. And the thing that's left open is, what does labor get out of it? Where does labor fit in? What part of the decision-making will labor have in these portentous days which are ahead? For we now realize that while it is true that a great deal of the issue of productivity is vested in the modernization of the buildings, the equipment, and the machinery which goes into making things, it is also true that a critical element in our reindustrialization effort must be the morale and the participation of American labor. In order to attain success in it, it is the men and women who operate these machines who will have to decide that issue. The tax incentives alone will not be sufficient to ensure that our industrial plan, our management ability, and our sales ability becomes once again the first and the foremost in the world. And so we need to consider most carefully the relationship of a new partnership in order to make the American economic scene more stable and more dependable between business and government and labor. And there are a few things that we have to consider in that regard. For one, we no longer can jump on a last-minute emergency basis into saving the Lockheeds and the Chryslers as we have up to now. And indeed, there is a grave question whether in this reindustrialization, the need for credit will be so great that it will be beyond the capability of any company. Unless we think that that's some far away, distant problem, take a good hard look at steel and automobiles. In the case of steel, the plants became obsolescent. We fell behind in the competition. The result? Tremendous loss of business, tremendous unemployment. Now, steel essentially has capital needs. And in the case of automobiles, we found management decisions very seriously wanting. Question, did labor participate in the decision which continued to turn out gas guzzlers when there was no market for them? Think about that. Think about it. There's a new role for labor in this economic world. And there's a new responsibility which at labor leaders you must consider very carefully. The opportunities will be wide open in the days ahead. The question for you is, will you avail yourself of them? And then one other thing. Building labor, building trades, have suffered immeasurably in these last years. With 20% unemployment, unbelievable and ridiculous. Just beyond understanding how we could accept any such decree when America is so underhoused and when so much of our housing and other structural assets in this country are so far behind the times. And so we're going to have to spend billions in helping our cities and our villages and towns to deal with all of the infrastructure which has been neglected for so long. It is said, and quite truly, and I found this in my battles, joined by Pat Moynihan, for getting New York City the aid that it needed, that the city was living literally on a powder keg. So ancient were the conduits, the sewers, the water mains, and everything else which extended under the street. But it was a miracle that one fine day the whole thing just wouldn't blow up. Now, Harry Van Osdale was telling me this morning, a very well-known caller, that it's fantastic that building labor should have suffered so much with America completely underhoused. And with a million members, he ought to know. And Ray and Howard and all of them feel exactly the same. So new concepts of financing, new concepts of cooperation will have to be developed in order to deal with this problem. And then there is the matter of establishing much better cooperation between labor and management on issues which are outside the collective bargaining process, issues which could make good markets, good labor markets, out of what might be poor labor markets, riven with strife, which young workers